Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lindsay Clauston, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu. For more information. The Hinckley Institute of Politics proudly presents the 17th annual Rocco C. and Marion S. Siciliano Forum. This year's theme is the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. This is one of 21 events that will extend through next Monday. For a listing of all the events, we encourage you to pick up a brochure in the back of the room. The title of today's forum is Trends and Transformations, the New Latin America. Our guest is Peter Schechter, the first director of the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsh Latin America Center, which promotes the political, economic, and social transformations in the region. During Schechter's tenure as director, the center has commissioned a game-changing poll on U.S.-Cuba relations, hosted Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto and Colombian President Santos, and was the leading outside voice on Mexican energy reform with the publication of a series of reports on energy policy in Latin America. In just 14 months, the center has held over 50 events and published 7 major reports based on original research. Schechter is convinced that the economic, political, and social transformations that have taken place in much of Latin America over the past decade make the region a uniquely attractive Western partner for the United States and Europe. The center aims to point to those transformations and the strategic partnerships possible with the region. An international consultant who has advised many heads of state and business leaders around the globe, Schechter's specialty and passion remain anchored in Latin America. He has more than 20 years of communications and political experience and is a sought-out voice on Latin American political issues. Fluent in 6 languages, Schechter specializes in reducing reputational risk in increasingly adversarial political and communications environments. Schechter previously served as the lead consultant on a host of high-stakes elections, overseeing polling, campaign management, advertising, and media relations in nearly every country in Latin America. In 1993, Schechter founded Klopak Leonard Schechter & Associates with 2 partners. Within a few years, it became one of Washington's premier strategic communications consulting firms. The firm continues today. Schechter teaches at 2 universities about issues at the intersection of international business, communications, and politics. He serves as a visiting professor at Ben-Gurion University's Faculty of Business and Management and was appointed to BGU's Board of Directors in 2012. Schechter is also an adjunct professor at the George Washington University and a published author, having released 2 novels to date with HarperCollins, Point of Entry in 2006 and Pipeline in 2009. He also co-owns several Washington restaurants and a Agur winery, a boutique winery in Israel. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Peter Schechter.
Thank you very much for that great introduction. I really appreciate it. Finally not wear a jacket, which I've worn incessantly all the way zipped up for the last month. Thanks so much for the warm reception. Thank you, Kirk, for inviting me, Kendall for having organized everything, Claudio for hosting us and hosting Rachel tomorrow. So we're really glad to be here from Washington, D.C. Before I begin with this presentation, I wanted to talk a little bit about myself. I know you kindly introduced me, but I wasn't really an intellectual or an academic. I ran a political consulting firm and did all of my work in political consulting in Latin America. So I've worked for a lot of political parties, a lot of presidents, a lot of heads of state. I've won a couple. I've lost a couple of elections. And then the Atlantic Council, where I work now, decided that it wanted to, it's one of the oldest think tanks in Washington, D.C., but this old, very prestigious think tank wanted to open a new Latin America center. So they were looking for a new director, and I got lucky, and I got hired as the new director. And that's important to say because I have a very different view about Latin America than a lot of my fellow Washingtonians have. My sense in Latin America from having not worked in Washington policy circles, but having worked in Latin American politics, my sense of Latin America is I've been very close and seen how Latin America has changed so radically in the last 15 years. This is a totally different continent and a completely different place from what it used to be 15 or 20 years ago. I remember that when I did my first poll in Latin America 20 years ago, it was dark and it was pessimistic and it was negative and people thought their government was bad, their country was going in the wrong direction, that their kids would have a worse life than they did. You do polling in Latin America today, notwithstanding all of the problems that there are with an economic business, with a business cycle slowdown that exists in Latin America today, you do polling in Latin America today and you are doing polling in the most optimistic region in the world today. Latin American polling always comes back with people believing that their countries have changed, their family opportunities have changed, the potential for their kids is much better than what it used to be. So it is and this is the message that I want to get out in Washington. I don't want to have another think tank that talks at Latin Americans. I want to have a think tank of Latin American voices that talks at Americans and tells the story of some of the transformations that exist in Latin America today. And it's actually very fun to come here and talk about this stuff today because in the last couple of months, we have been very busy with a lot of things happening in Latin America. There is amazing changes in U.S.-Cuba relations. There is a potential for a severe implosion in Venezuela, which we're now seeing the run-up to by a lot of arrests and repression of dissidents and repression of freedom of speech and assembly, where we have a potential for a unique peace in Colombia. For the first time in 40 years, the region's oldest guerrilla war is now being, the two sides are around a peace table in Havana, Cuba, and there is a real chance in this year that peace could be accomplished. There is amazingly good news and terribly bad news emanating from Mexico that has really captured a lot of the headlines in the last week, in the last months. And then there's worrisome conspiracies and murderous stories coming from Buenos Aires, Argentina. And so it makes for a very, very vivid moment in Latin American, to look at Latin America and to watch Latin America, and all of this combined with the fact that the administration, for the first time in a long, long time, the U.S. government has really re-engaged with Latin America. Latin Americanists always complain that Latin America is on the back burner. Well, it's not on the back burner, it's in the cupboard. And suddenly it's come out of the cupboard in a very big way. So I'm happy to talk about all of these things from Cuba to Venezuela to things during the Q&A session. But what I wanted to do today is to really try to take you on a magic carpet ride, if you will, and try to convince you of a little theory of mine. And my hypothesis basically goes like this, that there are 585 million Westerners that exist today in Latin America. These people, you don't have to teach them what democracy is. You don't have to teach them what women's rights are. You don't have to teach them what civil society is. It comes basically free in the DNA. And those 585 million Westerners are going to play an increasingly crucial part of in relations with the United States. And I think that as we look at some global megatrends that are occurring that I'm going to talk about in a second, as we look at some global megatrends, we're going to find out that the region in Latin American region stacks up pretty well with what's going on. So let's take a look. So as Bob Dylan said, the times, they are changing, and they're changing very, very fast. And the big question is, so where are we going? And to the answer of where we're going, we are lucky enough at the Atlantic Council to have a center that is run by futurologists. It's called the Strategic Foresight Initiative. Their job is to look into crystal balls. No, they don't dress like Merlin the magician, but they do look into crystal balls. And they try to point out where is the world going to be in 2025 or in 2030 or in 2035, and what are the main issues going to be for the world in those times. So up here you see what their seven global megatrends are. And I want to take one by one each of these megatrends, and I want to look at how Latin America measures up against these megatrends. How does Latin America do on these? So I'm going to take the first three very quickly, and then I'm going to linger on the last four a bit. On demographic changes, the region does pretty well, right? The region is the region's population is young, not quite as young as Africa or Asia's, but young. But this youth means and brings benefits like empowering women and getting more kids into school, though it also brings increased expenditures as you are trying to care for the elderly and things like that. Access to water and food, Latin America also here does very well in this regard. It's a net exporter of food products, with 11% of the world's food production being exported from Latin America, and this is only going to increase with technology. Innovation and disruptive technology, well, we all know how innovation has disrupted our lives in banking, in airline reservations, in the way we read books. And Latin America here is remarkably receptive to these changes. Latin America has the highest growth of internet access anywhere. 147 million people in Latin America have access to the internet, and Brazil alone has 77 million social network users. So social media in Brazil is the second largest after the United States. So, you know, I'd give the region a higher than average score on these first three, but it's the next four that really hit it out of the ballpark, because with urbanization and energy, Latin America really does amazingly, and it's sort of a global leader. And with the diffusion of power, brings a lot of the huge improvements and huge potential that I think Latin America can bring. So I want to look much more in depth at these four. So urbanization. On urbanization, just imagine one half of the world's population lives in urban areas, but not in Latin America. In Latin America, 80% of the Latin American population lives in urban areas, and it's going to be 85% by 2025, and that shift from rural to urban has been instrumental in the recent strong growth of the middle class in Latin America as cities stimulate productivity and reduce the cost of administration of human services. And cities are innovators. Cities are centers for a lot of the really interesting stuff that is going around. National cities produce 60% of national GDP. Cities are the centers and becoming centers of everything, of all of that bubble of activity that is being invented with innovation. And if you look at what Latin America has innovated in municipalities all around the region, you get a sense of how innovative Latin America is, because a lot of the stuff that was invented in Latin America you now find in New Delhi or in Jakarta or in Nairobi. Give you some examples. Something called a BRT, the Bus Rapid Transit. Bus lanes that move on smart energy red lights, and they move as fast as subways under New York City. They don't move with the traffic. They move separately from the traffic. Or you have cable cars. Now, here in Salt Lake, you have cable cars that bring people up to ski. But in Latin America, you have cable cars in cities that have mountains that have reduced the commute time of people from 4, sometimes 5 hours per day to less than 30 minutes. as people are picked up on one hill, and then the cable car goes to another hill, and then it goes to another hill, and then the cable car zooms into the center of town and drops people off so that they can go to work, and reduces commute times from, as I said, 4 or 5 hours to sometimes 20 minutes. So all of that has brought enormous changes in Latin America, and changes that have been basically run by mayors. Mayors in Latin America are extraordinary. And I'll give you one example of mayors that have done amazing jobs is in Colombia. You have mayors such as Sergio Fajardo or Aníbal Gaviria. These are mayors who have changed the town of Medellin. Now, Medellin, 20 years ago, you couldn't say the word Medellin without saying either the murder capital of the world or saying cartel, the word. Today, you say the word Medellin, and you suddenly get the word miracle. The Wall Street Journal voted Medellin the most innovative city in the world in 2013, beating out Sydney, Australia, and Tel Aviv, Israel. So mayors have fundamentally done enormous amounts to change, and no mayor has been as successful as that guy there, who you will see a lot of, because he's going to run the Olympics next year. His name is Eduardo Paes, and he's the mayor of Rio de Janeiro. And he's an amazingly interesting guy, because he's not only a mayor, he's also a philosopher, right? And he sells the following idea. He says that mayors today are running cities that are so big, you know, they have 6, 7, 8, 10, Mexico City and Sao Paulo, 20 million people in them. They're running cities that are so big that they're like running city-states, like Venice used to be in the 1600s. So these mayors, they have to take care of many more things than just potholes. They're taking care of people's education and health and technology needs and innovation needs. And that's why he says his view is that nation-states have been unable to find solutions to problems, and local governments, because they're so much closer to people, are going to be the way that you find solutions to people's problems in the future. So in municipal issues and in municipal technology and in municipal innovation, Latin America does extraordinarily well. I want to move on to the next thing, which is energy. Let's talk a little about energy, because energy is going to be a game changer. It's going to be a game changer for Latin America. It's going to be a game changer for the hemisphere. And it's going to be a game changer for the world. When global markets have no idea what's going to hit them, if we already see low prices today, but global markets are going to be very effective when Latin America comes fully on to the energy production cycle. If you just look around the hemisphere, you look at Brazil that has something called pre-salt deposits. The pre-salt deposits, President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil has called the pre-salt deposits the passport to the future, because they're producing today 500,000 more barrels of oil per day today than they were 5 years ago, and they're going to be producing 500,000 more per day in just 2 or 3 years, and this is going to accelerate sort of very rapidly. The same thing with Argentina. Argentina has probably the largest reserves of shale gas after the United States. And it, those same reserves called, with this very strange name, called Vaca Muerta, dead cow, the same reserves are going to produce 22.5. There's reserves of 22.5 billion barrels in Vaca Muerta. So these, just like happened in the United States, where we have had over the last 10 years a reduction from 73% of imported oil to today about 20 to 22% of imported oil, the same thing will happen in the rest of the hemisphere. Increasingly, the hemisphere is going to be self-sustaining in energy production, and that self-sufficiency is no longer a mirage, but a huge reality. And so when you talk about energy production, you can't, that's why I said and Mexico at the bottom, you can't leave, you gotta leave a very special place to talk about Mexico. Because Mexico just reformed its whole energy sector. And Mexico, the reforms in Mexico are an example of what can happen when a country decides that it must move to a much more open, to a much more competitive, to to much more engage with a very globalized world and far less nationalistic economic structure. And so Mexico was at a crossroads. Mexico was at a crossroads that was with low production, very high energy costs and very high electricity costs, and very little exploration of new possible productions. And so President Peña Nieto, a young 43-year-old president, the president coming from a party that was known for nationalizing things, decided that he had to change the game, and he produced a reform which essentially opens up Mexico to foreign, the Mexican oil sector to foreign investment. And that is probably going to change radically the Mexican ability to produce a lot of oil. There's going to be a growth of 500,000 barrels per day by 2018. There's 110,000 megawatts of increased production. 2 million jobs are going to be introduced into the market by 2025. GDP growth of 2% by the same time. There's a big debate in Mexico about whether this reform was necessary or unnecessary. And I will tell you from a political point of view, if you look at the Middle East, the debate about nationalization of oil versus allowing foreign investors is akin to the debate about Jerusalem. It's really the third rail of Mexican politics. And so this was a very, very difficult decision for President Peña Nieto to take, and yet I believe it will pay huge dividends. So here, too, we've seen the urbanization, and now in energy, Latin America has enormous, enormous potential. Now I want to get on to sort of the issues of distribution of power and the diffusion of power that exists. There is, because of the growing middle classes and because of the opening of markets and expanding technology, there is a diffusion of power that's going on both among states and inside the nation states. There's certainly a diffusion of power from the north and the west, in other words, from the United States and Europe, to the east and the south, to China, to India, and to countries like Brazil or Colombia or Mexico. And what's interesting about this is that it's not a zero-sum game. It's not that the United States, as Mexico or Brazil becomes more powerful and more enabled, the United States becomes less. It's just a diffusion of power. That same diffusion is occurring inside each of the countries. And it's occurring towards individuals, as I'm going to talk about in a second. It's also occurring towards groups and organizations in civil society, in which civil society become the validators for ideas. It's occurring, as Eduardo Paes says, the mayor of Rio, as the power is being transferred from national governments to local governments, and power is being increasingly moved to multilateral and international organizations. But that's all great news, and it's great news because that brings on individual empowerment and the growth of the middle class. According to the UN, by 2030, there will be 8 billion people in the world, and 6 billion of them are going to be in the middle classes. This is an unbelievable change and acceleration of prosperity in the world. For the first time, there are going to be more people in the middle class than there's going to be in poverty. And Latin America will be extraordinarily well-placed, with 70 million people that have come out of poverty in Latin America in the last 10 years. So what happens when 70 million people come out of poverty? What happens to them? What happens to their countries? How does the countries then change? And what do the middle classes access? Well, the first thing that happens is you get increased access to education. First, it's increased access to education at all, and then it becomes increased access to quality education. A lot of the things, the protests that you're seeing around the region are not only about having education at all or healthcare at all, but about improving quality of those services. Then you get decreased in gender disparity, and everything that comes when societies, everybody knows that society do so much better when women are empowered. So this has a plethora of benefits. You get high levels of penetration of telecommunications. And so it's not everybody who has a television at home that gets known, but all you have to do is to own a phone, and you have access to information, and you have access to the free market. There is a healthier population because they have access to medical care. All of this equates to more and more individual empowerment, which increases individuals' capacities to influence events directly and become owners of their own destiny. Now, with all of this good news also comes some warning smoke, because if five of seven of every seven people are going to be in the middle classes, this is going to put a tax on energy, on food, on water, that like we've never seen before. And like everything I've been saying, Latin America is very well equipped to deal with that. 25% of the world's remaining viable yet unused land for agricultural production is in Latin America. This can be used to feed a growing worldwide population. The energy revolution, which I've talked about, but also the hydroelectric potential of Latin America for sustainable and sustainable resources will also be engaged with this. And strong cities are going to be instrumental in this new world of the middle class. All right, so what I've told you about is my view that Latin America has great potential in the future. So if it has great potential, if all of what I've said is true, if Latin America is actually doing pretty well, why isn't Latin America more viewed as a global player or as a strategic partner? Why doesn't the United States view Latin America as an opportunity? Why doesn't the U.S. recognize these opportunities? Well, I think that changing paradigms take time and don't necessarily translate immediately into different realities. And, you know, I think that you can see that everywhere. The Foreign Policy magazine recently took a poll of international institutes, and there they asked the respondents to that poll what region in the world would be of strategic importance to the United States today. And 2% of the respondents from those major international relations schools answered that it would be Latin America. And what people said, and the next question was, what about in 10 years? What area is going to be very important to the United States, of strategic importance to the United States? Well, then it really increased. It increased to 3% of the respondents said that Latin America would be used. And you can see that not only in the response of elites, but you can see that in the press. If you look at this chart of how press covers, you get 6.5 million media hits about Latin America in the English-speaking press. This is half of what Africa got. Now, I admit that Africa gets a lot of its press because it gets a lot of bad press with Boko Haram, with problems in South Sudan, et cetera, et cetera. But still, I think it's really amazing that Latin America gets half of the media hits of what Africa gets. And it's not only in the media. The problem is also in places like Washington, D.C., where in Washington, D.C., at events, in think tanks, on the Hill, in Senate, in media coverage, it just isn't reflective of the new Latin America. This isn't what the new Latin America is all about. If you look at some of the things here that you see that has been covered recently in Washington, D.C., they're talking about the old stuff, right? There is this tendency to keep talking about Latin America within the context of violence, transnational crime, drugs, immigration, human rights, terrorism. But that's not what Latin America is talking about, right? There is a disconnect here about what is being talked about in Washington, D.C. versus what are the issues being talked about in Latin America. And so I think it is really time to change this outdated paradigm. And we've got to sort of reconnect and reorganize this conversation, because if we don't, we're going to just stay stuck in clichés and have no connection to reality. And this is particularly bad in Washington, the city in which I live in. Washington, which I think I describe as 20 years behind the rest of the country on you name any issue, Washington is 20 years behind. Because we're not only paralyzed, we're also polarized in Washington, D.C. So it's not a surprise that our nation's capital is rather delayed in updating itself on what's been happening in Latin America. And, you know, I think that these cliches are going to start dissipating, because if you look around the country, you know, I think that where things are beginning to change about, where people are beginning to change their views about Latin America is not in Washington, D.C., but it's in exactly like places like Salt Lake City, like Denver, like San Diego, like Miami, like Chicago, where businesses, where universities, where NGOs all are recognizing the enormous transitions that have occurred in Latin America. And they have been enormous transitions, right? If you look at some of these transformation indicators, let's take these six very quickly, right? If you look at governability and democracy, where we're seeing all around the region governability and democracy improving. There are exceptions. God knows that what's happening in Venezuela is a huge exception. What's been happening in Argentina in terms of free press is an exception. But in general, the trend lines have been more towards the positive, and there has been a lot of emphasis on social inclusion in Latin America. So that emphasis on social inclusion gives us a situation today in which the Mexican Congress has more women in it than the United States Congress. The Bolivian Congress has more indigenous peoples in it than the U.S. Congress. And so there is an enormous growth in people paying attention and caring about governability and democracy in Latin America. Now, I don't think any of this is going to bring us less conflict. It's going to bring us more conflict. We're entering a decade in which social conflict is going to increase, because I think social conflict increases as people who have now understood what it means to send their kids to school or to have access to neighborhood clinics now want better schools, now want better clinics. And so what you saw in Brazil just before the World Cup, this wasn't a protest of people who were starving and wanted food. This was a protest of people who had found out what it means to send kids to school and wanted better schools and better roads and more electricity into their neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we will see heightened conflict, and I don't think that's such a bad thing at all, right? We'll also see lower unemployment in Latin America. The IMF is predicting 2.2% growth in Latin America this year. Now, that's down from 4.5% just 4 years ago, but it's not catastrophic. 2.2% growth is something that a down commodity cycle can support, and that means that you will continue to have decreased unemployment, and indeed the International Labor Organization reports it for the Latin American Caribbean region. Unemployment went down again from 6.2% to 6.1%. And so important, because Latin America has this famous inequality, this famous skewed equality, income equality. So the Gini coefficient, which is the measurement that's pretty much used by everybody to measure inequality, has been improving in Latin America. If you look in 2003, Latin America had the highest Gini coefficient score that it ever had. But in 2013, it had the lowest Gini coefficient score than it ever had. And that means that we're at least heading in the right direction. It's not great, and this continues to be inequality that we're starting to talk about here in the United States. It has been a conversation that people have been having in Latin America for centuries. It's heading in the right direction. Hopefully it will continue to improve. But there are people who believe that the whole issue of whether how do we measure inequality and how do we measure growth needs to change. So Michael Porter, the famous dean of Harvard's Business School, invented this new index in which you are measuring countries not by their GDP growth, but you're measuring countries by a series of social indicators such as violence against women, access to education, clean water, the environment, housing, et cetera, et cetera. And Latin America does quite well in Dr. Porter's social progress index. And last, integration around the region is doing quite well. Very interesting thing happening, particularly among a series of countries that make up something called the Pacific Alliance. These countries make up about 35% of the region's population, about 38% of the region's GDP. They've agreed to try to integrate increasingly their economies. They've integrated their stock markets in something called MILA, in a very interesting experiment, which we'll see how it happens in the coming years. Some of the integration efforts are not doing so well, such as Mercosur, but the Pacific Alliance is doing very well. And last, U.S. exports are increasing to the region every day. Today, 40% of U.S. exports are sent to Latin America. It is the fastest growing, it is the region with the fastest growing number of U.S. exports. And if you compare what the U.S. sends to Europe, which is 21%, or to China, which is 7%, 40% of U.S. exports to Latin America is a big deal. And that's why the United States has made trade agreements with 11 countries in Latin America. Of the 20 countries that the United States has trade agreements with, 11 of them are in Latin America because there's a recognition of the potential that these growing middle classes have to consume U.S. products and services on an accelerated basis. And if you took a quick look at what the Colombian Free Trade, which was the last one that the U.S. signed, what the Colombian Free Trade Initiative did in its first years, trade with Colombia increased 20% in the first 12 months following the implementation of the trade initiative. So I'm just going to end here by saying, what's next? As you can hear from my passion and my opinions, I'm a pretty big optimist about where the region is going. I think we're in a very good place. But there are challenges, no doubt. One of the challenges is that the commodities boom has ended, and so now we're growing at this lesser rate. Latin America has to increase its innovation capacity and its efficiency to be able to increase growth. There remains a huge tension in the region between those who advocate policy changes on the basis of pragmatism versus those countries that advocate policy changes on the basis of ideology. And that seems to be a growing juxtaposition in the region, though I, there too, we can talk about it later, I'm pretty optimistic about how this is going to end up. And I'm very concerned about the implosion of Venezuela, both politically, but also the ramifications of Venezuela's implosion for its neighbors, in particular for Colombia, and for its Caribbean neighbors, who depend on Venezuelan oil to produce electricity every day. But I think that the number of opportunities outshine the challenges. The United States and Latin America, because of our increased connections, and these connections are not only about exports, but about the numbers of Latinos who live here and the numbers of connections that we have every day. Remember that $1.5 billion worth of trade crosses the Mexican-U.S. border alone. $1.5 billion crosses that border every single day. There is no doubt that the U.S. and Latin America are going to cooperate more and more on issues of mutual interest. There are innovations to share. I've talked to you about some of them. Municipal innovations, innovations in gastronomy. A lot of some of the best chefs are Latin American. Amazing innovations in incubators all around the region. You have 20% of social investment funds in London and New York that are invested in Latin America. And you have Latin Americans producing technologies which are now moving all around the world. Did you know that voting machines, I don't know if you're in Utah, you vote with voting machines, but voting machines, electronic voting machines, were begun and invented in Latin America. And, you know, I am very hopeful that, particularly in terms of Mexico, the North American energy integration between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico is going to have incredibly positive ramifications for the region. And I think those ramifications are going to be seen in other integration efforts in energy all around. There's the potential of peace in Colombia, and of course, the changes that are happening between the United States and Cuba have removed an enormous irritant between the region and the United States. I call it the pebble, the boulder-sized pebble in the shoes of America's relations with its neighbors. That boulder has been taken out of the shoe. And that's a very, very positive thing. So thanks much for listening. And what I hope is that even if you're not a Latin Americanist and you study Asia or you study women's issues or you study energy or you study trade issues, I hope you walk out of here saying, I ought to take another look at Latin America because there's interesting things happening there. Thanks very much. Glad to take questions.
Hi, my name is Jessica Talbot, and I am a pre-med political science major here at the University of Utah. And I know there's been a lot of increase in interest in economically engaging in Latin America and the United States, but do you feel that now is the right time to do that with all these different stripes, or would it be more advantageous to wait until the dust kind of settles?
No, I think Latin America is at a very good place, and now is exactly the time to engage economically with Latin America. I think, as I said, you got 40% of U.S. exports going to Latin America. I think it could grow as a percentage. I mean, you know, Europe is in an economic crisis. China is slowing down, and I think that that could grow. So I think there's a lot of reasons to believe that Latin America has an enormous potential for economic partnership with the United States. And I think now is the time to engage that even further.
Hello, I'm John Francis in political science. I was very taken with your commentary, but I'm also struck by the enormous variation within Latin America, so that the politics in Argentina look very different from Chilean politics and from Brazilian politics.
God knows.
Is it fair to kind of group them all together, or is there more variation that we should pay attention to?
Professor, it's unfair to group them all together. But I think that there's what I'm trying to sell here is a trend. So, I don't think that every country in Latin America merits the same optimism that I've tried to transmit and communicate. But I think as a trend, the region isn't at an interesting place. So you mentioned Argentina. God knows that the situation in Argentina is pretty bad. We have, I think anybody who reads the newspapers can see that there's a scandal with having to do with a bombing of a Jewish cultural center 20 years ago that has had no resolution at all. And now the prosecutor who was going to advance that investigation has been found dead. He's in a way the 86th victim of that bombing. And yet, if you look at the way this election is playing out in Argentina, we're going to get a change in Argentina. And that change is either going to be extraordinarily good, very good, or just good. But there are no candidates that are walking Argentina backwards. The three top candidates are all candidates of change. They're all candidates that believe Argentina has to integrate into a more globalized world. They're all candidates who believe that Argentina has to grow up. They're all candidates that believe that Argentina has to change its constitution to diffuse power away from Buenos Aires. Some believe this more than others. Some promise more radical reforms than others. But all of them believe that. So I think, in a way, you know, the continent is basically trending in a good place. And even problematic countries like Argentina are, hopefully, we can talk again after October, but hopefully we'll be in a much better place after October. Hi.
Hi, my name is Sherry Urich. I'm a chemistry major here. I was just wondering, right now, you say we're cooperating really well with Latin America, and that will tend to grow. But as Latin America grows and produces more exports, do you see them being more of a competitor than a cooperative with us?
Look, I think, you know, we live in a highly globalized world, so there are competitors everywhere, and there's no doubt that as Latin America grows, I mean, take a country like Brazil. I mean, Brazil used to produce shoes, used to produce textiles, et cetera, et cetera. Most of those shoe factories have moved to Cambodia and Laos and Myanmar. And now Brazil is producing enormous amounts of services, right? They want to sell medical tourism to Western Africa so that Western Africans, whether you're from Nigeria or Senegal or Cameroon, can come to Brazil to have surgeries, to get checkups, et cetera, et cetera. They want to sell banking services for the rest of Latin America. Anybody who reads The Economist sees that Banco Itaú has this ad in every single Economist in which they call themselves Latin America's bank, not Brazilian bank, Latin America's bank. So yeah, I'm sure that there will be increased competition between us. But I think, you know, that increased competition is also coming from India. It's also coming from China. It's coming from a number of places. And, it, you know, if you believe in capitalism, this will only make us better.
My name is Ken Jameson. I've worked in Latin America for a long time and seen where you came from. And I basically agree with what you're saying, but it's always ambiguous. And the energy presentation, for example, you are very happy about the increased oil, which, of course, has detrimental impacts on the environment. And so I wonder, I think Latin America is already being affected by global warming, and we're seeing some of the possible impacts, like in Sao Paulo and all. On the other hand, you have Bolivia that sits on lithium that could be the basis of energy storage. And so I wonder if you could deal in a bit more nuanced way with the whole energy issue throughout Latin America and the ambiguities there.
Well, I think the world is facing an impending, it sounds to me like you and I agree, is facing an impending crisis with global warming. Meanwhile, these countries have to feed their populations, and they have to make sure that electricity prices get delivered to companies and consumers at prices that are not astronomically higher than in other places. If you look at electricity prices in Mexico before the reform, they were, I think my numbers are correct, 25% higher than the United States. And if you look at electricity prices in Central America today, they're 75% higher than the United States. That condemns people to permanent poverty, because if they can't attract businesses to open up manufacturing plants and other ways to produce things, then you can't create jobs. And so I think that you have to find this precious balance. Now, Latin America has enormous potential for renewable power. I mean, they have enormous potential that is hydroelectric, they have wind, they have wave potential, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a lot of the interesting things that are happening in Argentina in particular with Vaca Muerta, which is the shale gas, at least in the transition away from using heavy oil like Venezuela's oil, in the transition as renewables come more and more into play, I think the hope is that one can move from heavy oils into gas and then into renewables. But, you know, these countries must become more competitive, or else they're condemned to, you know, a lifetime of poverty.
My name is Robert Neese, and I come from the fields of finance and risk management. And now, as my retirement as a senior, I'm studying history and Spanish. But you addressed some of the large countries for the most part of Latin America, and I was wondering what you can share with us about the Central American countries.
That's a very good question, because I've skewed a lot of my comments to Mexico, and then I basically jumped all the way to Costa Rica and down. And there is no doubt that many of the problems we see emanating from Latin America that dominate our newspaper coverage of Latin America basically emanate from what we call the Northern Triangle: Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Gang violence, poverty, lack of employment opportunities, mass immigration, drug cartels. I mean, these are endemic problems in these three Central American countries. And I don't think I'd include Panama or Costa Rica in that description. But those three countries in particular really have endemic problems. And I was very pleased to see that the Obama administration, after years and years, maybe 10, I don't know exactly, 10 or 11 years of shrinking foreign assistance budgets, had the political courage to propose an increase in the foreign assistance budget by adding $1 billion of foreign assistance to those three countries in Central America. If you look at the crisis that we had with the children coming to the United States, so 65% of those children that were coming to the borders and identifying themselves to U.S. border agents as miners came from one city in Honduras. 65% came from San Pedro Sula in Honduras. So, and how did they come? They came because parents wanted these children to leave. They thought that a life with Aunt Rosa in Miami or with Uncle Pedro in Texas is much better than they're going to have a life condemned to gang crime and violence that they had, that they were looking at at home. So, you know, they sent them on well-organized trips to the north. I mean, people were competing for, I'll take your children to the border, coyotes. But it's a very serious situation, and I'm very pleased that the administration is recognizing this and taking a leadership position in this.
My name is Chris, and I'm studying public administration with a research emphasis in Cuba. One of your challenge points, you had put the implosion of Venezuela. I was curious, the same week that President Obama announced this historic change towards Cuba, we have initiated sanctions against Venezuela. And I was wondering how the implosion and kind of the domestics that are happening in Venezuela is going to affect either specifically the Cuba relationship, but also kind of other partners in the region, where Venezuela was kind of galvanizing the group, so to say.
So I don't want to take the wind from my colleague Rachel Deliviori, who's talking tomorrow on Cuba. So I will stay away from the word Cuba and stay on the word Venezuela. I guess the first thing I'd say is you have to be careful with those sanctions. I don't usually defend my friends at the State Department, but I know I'm channeling them here to say there's sanctions on individuals in Venezuela, not sanctions on Venezuela. There's sanctions on certain individuals. They're a completely different type of sanctions than we have on Cuba. There is no doubt in my mind, forgive me, Rachel, there's no doubt in my mind that Cuba had to make a decision given where it was. They didn't want a third time losing a sponsor. There's no doubt that they depend incredibly on Venezuela's cheap oil. And so Cuba has been there a number of times before in which it lost its sponsor, the United States, the Soviet Union. And so I think to a large extent what happened, the impetus that President Castro had to do the deal with President Obama is very much linked to what's happening in Venezuela. I think the best description that I have heard about what happens in Venezuela is, and we have a disagreement in our center, my deputy director, who is a guy whose judgment I admire enormously, keeps saying Venezuela is on the brink of implosion. I don't think Venezuela is on the brink of implosion. I think Venezuela is imploding, but I don't think it's on the brink of a total implosion, right? And the best description that I've heard is from a very senior diplomat who described the situation in Venezuela as follows. The people would love to hear, Venezuelan exiles would love to hear me say that the car has gone over the cliff. And it's done. The implosion is happening. My view, said this diplomat, is that the car has not gone over the cliff. That the car is out of brakes. The driver is out of control. The curves are getting more and more dangerous. The pendiente, the slope is getting more and more, is getting higher and higher, but the car is still on the road.
My name's Jason Nielsen. I'm a business grad here, and I did a Hinckley internship in Mexico. My question is, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I believe you touched on it briefly, what is your take or how do you respond to the opposition of that partnership?
From
where they say that only five, for example, five portions of that agreement or that proposal only deal with actual trade. The rest is heavy toward investors, and they're claiming that it gives too many rights to corporations over local governments.
Right. We should talk about this offline because it's a subject that deserves its own session here. But let me just say one thing and go back to the question on Central America. There is a real problem with the TPP about what happens to smaller countries in the region that I care about, in Latin America. So, for example, We met 2 days ago with the Minister of Economy of El Salvador, who is incredibly concerned about what happens to his textile industry. And by the way, because of CAFTA, a lot of U.S. textile manufacturers moved to Central America, Hanes and others like that, moved to Central America and the Dominican Republic in order to take advantage of the CAFTA access to the United States market, so to produce textiles in El Salvador. With TPP, basically he gets his country, he quote-unquote gets ransacked by countries like Vietnam that have state-owned enterprises that don't have similar private sector cost calculations as companies like Hanes do in El Salvador. So, you know, he is trying to communicate an enormous concern about what the results of TPP will be on smaller Latin American countries. Now, there's four larger Latin American countries that are part of the TPP negotiations. But we can talk more offline.
Okay, thank you so much for all of your great questions. And if you guys could all join me in thanking Peter Schechter today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for